The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold on the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
Take control of your growing company's finances with Bill Spend and Expense, the free-to-use spend management software powered by the Bill Divvy Corporate Card. With credit lines from $50,000 to $5 million, Bill Spend and Expense is here to help you thrive. Say goodbye to manual expense reports and juggling multiple cards, and say hello to saving time and eliminating wasteful spend. Try Bill Spend and Expense today at bill.com/promo500 and get $500. Terms and conditions apply. Advertised credit ranges are not guaranteed and are determined at approval. Card issued by Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So then she's screaming out, you know, hey, my window blew out and I'm bleeding. And then we're right after that, I hear a ping, like somebody walked up and smacked a sledgehammer on the side of the plane. And then right after that, my co-pilot and I see orange tracer rounds going up right in front of the nose. And then everything kind of comes smashing together all at once. And we realize, holy cow, we're getting shot at.
Want to make a podcast? Let me tell you about Spotify's program for podcasters, and it's called Spotify for Podcasters. I've been using it for over a year now. Couldn't be happier from the switch. You can record wherever you create podcasts, whether it be your phone, computer, and it's easy to upload it and distribute it to everywhere podcasts are heard. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. Best of all, Spotify for Podcasters is completely free. So launch your podcast today. Get started with Spotify for Podcasters. Go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started.
Monarch, Legacy of Monsters, an Apple original series.
The world is on fire. I decided to do something about it.
On November 17th.
This place, it's not ours. Believe me.
The most massive event of the year arrives.
Come with me, you'll know everything, I promise.
Oh my God, go, go, go!
Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. Streaming November 17th, only on Apple TV+.
Tower, Demarestation is released to you. Runway 4 left, 4040 at 5. Clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altair 0 eyes. We're clear for takeoff. Clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
My paragraph curve was at 354.
Sir, that's off.
Nice.
Just like that, Chris, man, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ryan.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the joke. I mean, it's always a challenge to coordinate schedules with people flying around the world, et cetera. But this one takes the cake. So it's a long time coming. We first met flying MC-12s way back when.
True.
And look at you now, flying the mighty Herc. You're a C-130J pilot, but I want you to jump in, just kind of give me the 60 to 90 second elevator pitch of who you are, a little bit of your background, and then we're gonna jump into some of your career here.
Sounds good. Chris Richardson, go by Chewy, born and raised in western South Dakota, Mount Rushmore area. People have been out playing tourists. Did ROTC at South Dakota State. Got married after that and drug my new wife to Vance for pilot training.
Nice.
And then got a, Enid America. then got a combo drop at a pilot training because that's what they were doing at that time because they needed so many people to man the MC-12 gig. So I got an MC-12 with a C-130 follow-on to Little Rock. So PCS to Little Rock and then went and did the MC-12 deployment, which is where you and I crossed paths. Came back, went to the C-130 FTU, spent about 3.5 years at Little Rock flying the Herc, then went to Laughlin to do what we call a white jet tour as a T1 IP, and then about 2019 or so came back to Little Rock, got requalled in the Herc. Did another like 3-year stint on the AMC side, and then last month I just walked over to the FTU, so now I'm helping with the schoolhouse.
Yeah, that's got to be a good gig, teaching people how to fly the mighty Herc, I would imagine. But
yeah, it's a lot around the flagpole, but it's good teaching.
Here's a question. This is random, and then we're going to jump into, I want to talk about the Distinguished Flying Cross you received, but a quick question for the C-130. Do you do heavyweight assault landings? Do you train, like, actually in the plane at Little Rock, or is that sim only?
No, we do it in the plane. It's a quarterly or normal bean requirement every year. So I file that away in like things we don't tell the taxpayers, but to get our heavyweight assaults on like a training line, we'll put on, we call them pet rocks, but they're literally giant concrete blocks that we put on a pallet and we'll load up 2 or 3 of those and then take on some extra fuel so we can get to the weight requirement to log a heavyweight assault. And then we'll fly around and get whatever practice we need.
All right, and tell me, what's the criteria for a heavyweight assault landing? What does it look like as far as weight and then runway length?
Runway length really isn't too much of a factor. It's just based on whatever the conditions, but we usually need to be above like 135,000 pounds to count it as a heavyweight assault.
Okay.
And then anything under that is just normal. So on a training line where we don't have cargo, we got to make cargo. So like I said, we'll load up some pet rocks and go fly around.
What's the shortest runway you can land on? Like if you're landing at 130K, what are you looking at?
I mean, depending on the conditions, if it's lower altitude, we can still, for training wise, 3,000 feet are min, but in like a deployed environment, it's whatever the total allows. So
right.
If the box says you can do it, you can do it. So
yeah, man, that's 3,000 feet short. And I know you're talking about the conditions, right? Density, altitude, temperature, all those things come into factor. Wet runway, runway condition, if it's probably mud, et cetera. So that's wild. 3,000 feet for a big old plane is impressive. Dude, I want to jump into the Distinguished Flying Cross story and really dig into that. And then when we're done, we'll talk maybe a little bit more about your career and we can shed some light on kind of how you got to this point. But I have it pulled up here. And I'll post this as well, but the Distinguished Flying Cross, that's a big deal. On September 19th, 2020, you're executing a mission out in Afghanistan. You're ingressing into an airfield. You guys get shot at, take effective fire, hits one of your crew members. You attempt to come back around and land. Doesn't work out, and you end up going back and getting another plane. That's like the high-level summary. Am I right?
Yep.
Can you jump into the... The 19th, what was that mission? What were you doing? What was it frag for?
Yeah, so the frag of the mission was to take us theater response force into Kunduz. So we're going to, we're one of two fixed wing assets to bring a bunch of people in there real fast. The Army is going to do an op, and then we're going to exfil everybody and leave, take them out of there. Was kind of the general game plan of that. So to kind of set the stage, this is fall of 2020, so about 11 months before our exit from Afghanistan, which at the time, if you had told me, hey, 11 months from now, we're not going to be in this country anymore, I would have said, hey, you're crazy. Like, what are you talking about? Yeah. I've been here for 20 years, practically having an apartment here.
Right. Some great real estate.
Yep. So anyway, for listeners, like, they've always been a C-130 presence the entire time we were in Afghanistan. There's either one squadron at Bagram or sometimes there's a second squadron at Kandahar. But, and then for the last, you know, few years we were there, it was just a constant rotation of that four C-130 AMC squadrons in and out of Bagram to provide that organic airlift support in country and then kind of connect it to the rest of the Persian Gulf. So,
because I mean, with the majority of the sorties is inner theater airlift or inner country airlift, so predominantly flying like Bagram to different forward operating bases.
Yeah, Bagram is definitely the hub of kind of the standard hub and spoke systems. Probably half the lines would bounce around Afghanistan to do whatever was needed, and then probably the other half would go into Kuwait or Al Udeid, bring people in and out of country that needed to. So, like I said, we were on our standard four-month rotation. So we went out there in May, and we were coming home the end of September. So that's kind of the quirk of this story is this mission was actually the last mission on the last day we were responsible for the ATO. And then our sister squadron was taken over, and then kind of everything falls apart.
Yeah, never let your guard down, right?
No, never rest. So anyway, like I said, we originally weren't even supposed to be flying the, so like I said, there's a height of COVID. So everybody coming into the CENTCOM AOR needs to, at that time, had to go to Al Udeid, quarantine for 2 weeks, and then go after that to your deployment location. So we actually left home station early, did our 2 weeks in the deed, and then, went to Bagram, set up shop. Swapped out the Dias squadron that was there. So then our sister squadron from Little Rock's coming to relieve us in September. I don't know what the exact story ended up being, but basically there was a little disagreement on when their clock started in the deed for their 14 days. So basically they got more or less delayed a day and a half or 2 days coming in to replace us. We're like, we'll just take the ATO for those two more days. My crew got picked to do this mission, so we were kind of excited. Do something different right before we leave, something a little non-standard. And then, so this was like a Saturday night mission. Sunday, the whole squadron's going to out-process. Monday morning, we're taking our jets and going home.
What were you guys having to do a lot of the COVID protocols and all that, separating and wearing masks when you're deployed?
It wasn't too bad, like, on base, just operating as a squadron. Obviously, the chow hall was closed, so you're just grabbing food and going.
Really?
That kind of thing. But we did spend quite a few missions with our air medical evacuation counterparts that are always deployed with the C-130 unit, like moving COVID patients around Afghanistan.
Okay.
Kind of centralizing them at Bagram.
So on this day, 19 September, you guys are bringing in a bunch of Army dudes into a forward operating base. Is the plan for you guys to stay there while they conduct their operation, or are you taking back off and going back?
No, we're taking back on. So we're doing an infill, exfill. So we got men and people and equipment that are kind of playing a big part in the mission since there was only two fixed wing assets going in there. So the plan was go in there, drop everybody off, come back to Bagram, wait for the op to be over, and then fly back up to Kunduz, do the exfil, and then bring everybody back to Bagram.
What is that timeline supposed to look like?
It's only 100 miles to Kandu, so it's a pretty short flight up there. Do an engine running offload, kick everybody off basically as fast as possible so they can do their thing, and then sit back at Brogham for 3, 4, 5 hours, whatever they needed to finish the op, and then go back and pick them up.
Okay. And then where you're going into Kandu's, what type of environment is that? FOB relatively established, or where are you guys going into?
I mean, it's an established FOB, but it's a little bit on the smaller side as far as the other FOBs in Afghanistan. It's got a decent runway, but kind of borders the town and then a bunch of open area, and there's a little bit of terrain to deal with there, but definitely not a huge presence, so that's why we're bringing in so many people and equipment for the op, so they could set up whatever they needed to, their security.
Did you guys have any fires that were going to be above you, supporting you, like the ingress, where I assume there had to be some Apaches, at least at a minimum, that would provide cover?
Yeah, there was a whole stack that was built up for the op, kind of back to the MC-12 days, kind of ISR assets of a whole bunch of different types, you know, gunships, the whole thing.
Going into this, I mean, I would have to imagine month 4, you've probably done this a whole bunch. Obviously, you had a lot of time in Afghanistan, the MC-12. Comfort level has got to be pretty high, I imagine. Was there any kind of complacency, you think? Or, I mean, complacency is probably not the right term, but it's just putting your pants on to go to work almost. Or was it different for you?
Yeah, I mean, we had been into Kandu's probably a dozen times just on this deployment alone. So it was like, hey, we're going to the same field we've done to do normal cargo runs both day and night. We're just tweaking the mission a little bit and doing something different this time with, you know, different requirements for the customer.
Interesting. And how many guys were you dropping off, roughly?
We had like a few dozen. And then a couple vehicles and some other equipment.
Okay. Interesting. All right. So walk me through, as you guys are, walk me through from when you airborne and going into there when things start going awry.
Yeah. So we do our rehearsals Friday night. Everything goes well. Saturday, take off on time. Everything's going great. Like I said, short hop up there. We get up to the Kandu's area, check in with the JTAC, confirm our airspace assignment. We get some TCAS traffic that pops up from one of the ISR assets. So we kind of adjust our descent a little bit and our approach. And then kind of, we call it a penetration descent, but then we start kind of a max effort, high speed descent to get us down to the approach as quickly as possible and kind of minimize our time in the WES.
What does that look like?
I mean, it's basically like, hey, rip it to idle, point the nose at the ground, like make sure, you know, all the math works out beforehand, says we're going to make it, but kind of just get going. So then I probably shouldn't have done it. It was my fault. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, hey, everything's going pretty well. And then that's when everything just kind of fell apart after that. So in the C-130, we fly, well, for deployment, standard setup is aircraft commander, co-pilot, and then two loadmasters as our four-person min crew deployed. And then we'll home station, we fly with whoever ends up on the schedule. Deployed, we'll do hard crews for scheduling efficiency. So on a four-month deployment, you'll have one crew for 2 months, and then halftime, swap it up, do another hard crew for another 2 months. So this crew, we've been flying every other day for 2 months, so you get to know everybody's mannerisms, how they sound on the intercom. You know, you can kind of predict what people are going to say, that kind of thing. And then we'll kind of balance out for risk management purposes, we'll balance out the experience level on the crew. So you'll put the brand new co-pilot with the instructor. You'll put the high time co-pilot with the brand new aircraft commander. And then we'll do the same on the loadmaster side. So Staff Sergeant Jade Morin was my experienced instructor loadmaster. And then Airman Carden was my, we call him a baby load just for short term, but my inexperienced loadmaster on his first deployment. So anyway, we're kind of at the bottom of our pen D. We're in a left bank. We're just getting ready to level off to start our approach. And then Sergeant Morin just yells over the intercom, my window blew out. So I'm like, well, that doesn't make any sense. We're like completely depressurized. And then she says, hey, my window blew out. I'm bleeding everywhere. I'm like, this is escalating quickly, to say the least.
Are you normally depressurized? Like, what altitude did you start this? I'm assuming high teens, low 20s. You're cruising over there?
Yeah, we were up in the 20s. And then we're getting down to probably like less than 2,000 feet.
And then are you pressurized up in the high teens, low 20s, or is that something that tactically you depressurize?
No, we'll stay pressurized up there, but we'll depressurize early before we get into the WES. There's most people have probably seen a C-130, even if they're not, didn't recognize what they're looking at, but the towards the back of the aircraft in front of the ramp, we call them the paratroop doors. There's two doors that slide up, and that's the primary exit if we're dropping paratroopers via static line. We can drop a stick out of each side of the aircraft at the same time. So that door has about a 2x2 window in the middle of it. And the Loadmasters have a really fancy crash-worthy air crew member seat that kind of folds in front of that window. And they scan out that window during approach and departure, looking for threats. So that's where Sergeant Morin was sitting on the left side of the aircraft as we were making that turn. And so then she's screaming out, you know, hey, my window blew out and I'm bleeding. And then we're right after that, I hear a ping, like somebody walked up and smacked a sledgehammer on the side of the plane. And then right after that, my co-pilot and I see orange tracer rounds going up right in front of the nose. And then everything kind of comes smashing together all at once. And we realize, holy cow, we're getting shot at. It was probably a little temporal distortion to me. It felt like it took quite a while, but this whole thing probably was a matter of seconds. So then when we kind of figure out what's going on, evasively maneuver kind of where our standard procedures away from the threat, get up out of the WES, and then I kind of turn south and point us back towards Bagram. Since our whole world just got blown up, I'm like, we need to start putting the pieces back together. So I'm like, hey, we just got engaged, plane got hit. I know there's an issue with a crew member. I'm just going to point us towards home, and then we'll start figuring it out. So checked in with the JTAC. Hey, tell them, hey, we're peeling off for right now. Call back to the back of the plane to my young loadmaster. I'm like, hey, what's going on back there? Because at this point, Jade's not on intercom anymore. And he's just glued to his window, like scanning for threats. He's like, no, we're clear outside. I'm like, hey man, yeah, we're good. Turn around, what's happening behind you? Because they sit across from each other. He's like, oh, they're working on Jade. So he had two combat controllers in the back of the plane. They were the ones sitting closest to Sergeant Morin. So they were Johnny on the spot. They reached up and yanked her out of her seat, got her behind the armor, started giving her first aid. So I'm like, all right, cool. Carden, I need you to check in, check the rest of the army dudes, make sure nobody else is injured, and then do a battle damage assessment in the back of the plane. Like, look around, do you see anything wrong? And then get back to me.
Were you guys the first ones? I assume you guys are probably your two ship, both flying the same rough flight path, the penetration in there?
Monarch, Legacy of Monsters, an Apple original series.
The world is on fire. I decided to do something about it.
On November 17th.
This place, it's not ours. Believe me.
The most massive event of the year arrives.
If you come with me, you'll know everything, I promise.
Oh my God, go, go, go!
Monarch, Legacy of Monsters, streaming November 17th, only on Apple TV+.
Level up your listening with Bose Quiet Comfort Ultra Earbuds and Headphones. With immersive sound and world-class noise cancellation for a not-so-silent night. Visit Bose.com/Spotify to shop sound that's more than a present.
Yeah, we were just a single ship. Okay. We were going in first, and then MC was coming in later to basically like set up a FARP for all the helos.
Paint a picture for the terrain. Is it high terrain, or where do you think you took fire from? To me, like night, I assume, again, you're blacked out. So the fact that these guys hit with effective fire like right off the get-go, they had to be having some assistance.
Yeah, so that was kind of the planning element, is this was like right at dusk. So we're in like kind of the worst time to be flying, but that's what we needed to do to meet the Army's requirements for their timeline of the op. So we're right between the, hey, I can't see great, and NVGs aren't effective yet because it's not dark enough.
Yeah, terrible time.
Yeah, if it was 20 minutes, 25 minutes to the right, we would have been completely blacked out. Probably wouldn't be talking to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, let's see where we live.
Yeah, so you peel out of the fight just basically to, all right, hey, we got shot at, we're shot up, like let's reassess. You turn south.
Yeah, so we're heading back to Bagram. My young loadmaster's kind of doing his BDA check in the back of the plane. We're putting all the pieces back together. Thankfully, so one of the ground force troop commanders in the back of the plane had asked beforehand, hey, is there a way I can listen to and transmit on the command and control C2 SATCOM frequency? We're like, yeah, we can figure that out. So the loadmasters have these really long comm cables that they use. They can walk around the back of the airplane, go outside like during engine start or something like that. So we grab an extra one from another plane beforehand. We rig it up on the flight deck with one of the extra comm panels, and then run that cord all the way back so he can plug in and listen to the C2 frequency. So he's sitting in one of the vehicles like right in front of all this. So he literally has a front row seat. So he starts talking on the SATCOM freak, which I'm listening to in the cockpit, so I actually get a pretty good like SA update. So he's like, hey, we took, telling C2, hey, we took fire. One of the loadmasters is injured. She's got a head laceration. So what had happened, the plane ended up only taking 3 rounds. One round went clean through the tail, not a big deal, there's nothing to hit. The second round hit Sergeant Morin's window basically right in front of her face. Thankfully, the outer pain stopped the round, but the overpressure basically caused the inner pain to explode.
Okay.
And then she took all that plexiglass shrapnel to the forehead above her right eye, and then punched about a 2 to 3 inch hole in that window with a bunch of cracking. And then we took the third round, was behind the paratroop door up closer to the cockpit. So he's like, hey, she has a, so he's updating C2. Hey, she's got a head laceration. And so now we're like, okay. And then at that time, my young loadmaster checks back in. He's like, hey, all the other Army guys are fine. I don't see anything wrong with the plane. So we're kind of putting all these pieces back together. And then I'm like, all right, well, the plane's fine. Jade's got a survivable wound. This isn't like a life, limb, or eyesight type of thing. Everybody else is fine. We're basically still like mission effective. And then I'm kind of like, they're going to ask us to go back. And I'm like, I don't really have a reason to say no. Like, I can't really get to know right now after putting all the pieces back together. And then sure enough, right after that, over C2, they're like, hey, are they reattempting the approach? Like, they got to figure out, are they going to go to contingency planning or whatever? So then I'm like, yeah, yeah, tell them we're coming back. We'll give it another try. So I talked with my co-pilot, Christian. I was like, hey, this is how we're going to change up the approach. Obviously, we're going to stay away from where we just got shot at. And then told my loadmaster, hey, tell the troop commander, like, hey, this is their 5-minute warning, and we're making a right turn and heading back in. So we did that, started another Pendy down to a shorter approach. Same type of thing, everything was going good. Talking up my loadmaster, on the way in, like, hey man, this was supposed to happen with two of you. Jade's out of the picture. It's all on you. So time to step up.
Be a champion. Kind
of slow as, so yep, be a champion, slow as smooth, smooth as fast type of thing. You know, and then I got all the confidence that you can get it done. We got on the approach, start slowing down to configure the airplane, call for flaps 50, which is like our half kind of flap position. Slow down a little bit more, put the gear down. And then at that point, I can tell just something doesn't feel right with the plane. And then I look down at the flap indicator and it's reading zero. And then at this point, I'm pissed because I'm thinking my co-pilot, I apologize to him later, but yelled at him. I was blaming him. I was like, I thought he wasn't paying attention. I'm like, hey, flaps 50. And then he comes back and says, they are at 50. So I look down at the lever. So the flap selector's at 50, but the indicator's at up. And the plane's flying like it's...
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In a no-flap configuration. So now I know we got flight control malfunction. So then that's kind of my black or white decision point. So we go around, deconfigure. I point us back towards Bagram. Check off with the JTAC again, being like, hey, we got more of a malfunction, and we're going to have to RTB because we can't land there. No flap landing in the stretch C-130 is a significant emotional event, so that is not an option on the runway up there.
Is that based on the, I mean, I'm at the speeds, obviously, are going to be much faster. Going into a FOB, not where you want to be. But it, I mean, is it a significant emotional event, a no flap landing in a C-130?
Yeah, it's not so much in the standard C-130. Like, the H model is pretty short, but... the AMC C-130Js or the stretch models are about 15 feet longer. Yeah, and it does create, it's very pitch sensitive as far as touching down the runway to avoid striking the tail.
Okay.
And then, like you said, a lot faster speeds, a lot more runway required. So we start, we start tracking towards Bagram. I'm like kind of relieved at this point. I got my black and white decision. We're RTBing, going back. And then now I'm like, well, now I got a potentially a pressurization problem, because if anybody's operated in the Bagram environment, it's basically in a bowl surrounded by 16,000 plus foot mountains. And now I got a plane with at least that window is now compromised and could create a pretty big hole. So we talk about it as a crew, be like, hey, we're going to head directly back. Tell my loadmaster, hey, keep an eye on that window, and then we'll prep for a rapid decompression if that window were to fail, and kind of work our way back. At this time, medic was working on Jade in the back of the plane, brought her up to the flight deck, and finishing bandaging her up. And then, so the other part is the C-130, when we're deployed, you know, you got your maintainers, you got your aircrew flight equipment personnel, you got your intel folks, you got your SARM troops. So most of them, sometime during the deployment, will hop on a mission, kind of get out away from the base for a little bit, see what they're supporting, that right. Kind of thing. So our SARM NCO, IC, Master Sergeant Davis, hadn't been out on a sortie yet, for whatever reason, busy, and somebody was like, hey, this is the last mission going out if you want to hop on. So they asked me, and I'm like, yeah, I'm fine with it. It'll be this short hop up to Kandus and back. It'll be something interesting to see. So she was actually just observing, just sitting in the jump seat, which later it was thankful that she was there, because she could kind of help out with Sergeant Morin. But at that point, I look back over my shoulder as we're trucking back towards Bagram. She's filling up a puke bag, you know, with all the maneuvering and all the stress. And then Sergeant Morin's getting bandaged up on the bunk behind the jump seat, just bleeding everywhere. And I'm like, well, look at this. I got a puker, a bleeder, and a broke-ass plane. Like, this is quite the day that I picked.
This is a great one to finish up on.
Yeah.
Yeah, hey,
yeah, perfect. This is one way to finish up the deployment.
Do you have any indication that, like, I'm assuming hydraulically operated flaps, maybe you'll get to what caused it, but no indications, no cautions, warning lights, anything like that going off?
No, not for that. They're hydraulically operated, electronically controlled. So what had ended up happening later when maintenance kind of, you know, took the airplane apart, that third round that hit the plane close to the crew entrance door up behind the cockpit, because we were in a left bank in the C-130, we got a bunch of wires and mechanicals and everything that runs along the top center line section of the aircraft, kind of maximize space in the cargo compartment. Because we were in a left bank, that round had an angle up into the top section of the aircraft and basically cut a wiring harness going into one of our circuit breaker control units that happened to have the flap controller on that specific unit.
Thank God it wasn't your HUD.
Yeah, that would have, man, you get used to the HUD. That, we love that thing.
Real nice.
But anyway, yeah, so it gave us kind of a false hydraulic failure on a different pump, which wasn't a big deal because that has a redundancy, but then you're not going to know anything's wrong with the flaps until you go to actually use them. So it kind of simulated that whole unit failing by cutting that wiring harness. So until we went to use them, there was nothing we could do. So we start trucking back towards Bagram. Pressurization's fine. The window's kind of flexing quite a bit, but it's holding. Jade's kind of patched up. And then once we finally get kind of over the top of the mountains, get line of sight with Bagram, then that's when I can check in with ATC, declare an emergency. Hey, tell them we're going to go hold because we need to take care of our mechanical problem. Call ops back at the squadron. They had been monitoring the C2 situation or frequency, so they knew what was going on, but I gave them my short version. Said, hey, we're gonna go take care of our stuff and I'll call you back when we're inbound. So my co-pilot and I run through the checklist. Thankfully, there's a lot of redundancies in using the flaps, so we're able to override the hydraulic valve and manually get the flaps down and then head back in to Bagram with no issue, clear off the runway, clear up with the fire chief, and then I call my buddy who's sitting ADO at the ops desk. I'm like, hey, what's the plan? Like, you guys have been sitting around at ground speed zero, so yeah, hopefully
the next jet should be ready to go.
Yep, so he called back and he's like, hey, we got another plane, like, pre-flighted, ready to go. After you get into parking. And so we went and parked, and then that was kind of the cool part, is just seeing an entire squadron, when something has to get done, like, just jump into action, literal, like, beehive of activity. So we parked, shut down, ambulance takes Jay to the hospital, bunch of loadmasters start transloading all the packs and cargo and vehicles to the other plane. Two buddies of mine are have it basically completely pre-flighted, basically ready to crank engines. A couple of co-pilots, you know, grab me and my co-pilots, like, all our flight gear, take it over to the other plane. I tell my co-pilot, hey, just, you know, get the flight plan loaded up. I'm gonna run in to tactics, get an intel update on anything they need to tell us before we take back off, and then we'll get out of here. I know you've mentioned General O'Malley, Maestro, before on the podcast. He was actually the wing commander out of Bagram at this time. Yep. So credit to him. Yeah, he was a good dude. I got a story about him later, but
good. Yeah, I'm trying to get him on the podcast. You know, we name drop him all the time, but
we do. He was fun to fly with. But anyway, to his credit, like, obviously he knew what was going on. Came down to the flight line, you know. And senior leaders sometimes have a issue with injecting themselves, you know, into a situation, but he was just like, well, looks like you got it covered. Like, ran into my squadron commander, was like, hey, take care of your stuff, let me know if you need anything, and you know, he went back to what he was doing. So we appreciated that quite a bit.
Yeah, it sounds like him.
Yep. So anyway, nothing really for the Intel update. So everything gets loaded up. We hop on Crake engines, and then basically we had taken on two extra loadmasters. So the kind of our senior enlisted loadmaster who was helping the Army plan everything out, he briefed them up on the plan and what was supposed to happen. So they literally walked on the plane and were like, hey, we're ready to go. Another pilot jumped on just to see an extra set of eyes scanning in the cockpit, going back up for threats and stuff. So, and then, Christian, my co-pilot, like, we were cranked engines, we're just getting ready to taxi. And I'm like, oh, hey, I haven't really checked in with you. Like, are you good? Like, are you ready to go? He's like, yep, let's do this. So we taxi out, take back off. And then the rest of that was pretty vanilla. Just flew up to Kunduz, did the infill as planned, came back to Bagram, sat around for, I think it was 3 or 4 hours till they were done with the op, and then flew back up, rinse and repeat, pick everybody up for the exfil, and then bring them back.
The cover of darkness helps a little bit. I have a question. Pressurization, again, not come from that world. But for those who don't know, you did mention Bagram, like, sits in a bowl. My first time taking off out of Bagram in an MC-12 going up to the northeast, I was like, I don't know if we're going to, like, clear this mountain. I'm like, do we need to do a 360 to make it up over this mountain? Did you guys have to come in above, or did you come around it? Like, were you in oxygen? These are, like, just super technical, in-the-weeds type questions. But I'm thinking, you're not – the cockpit – or the plane's no longer pressurized. You got a big hole in it. So – would you guys have to wear an oxygen mask? I don't know how any of that works.
So we were ready to go on oxygen. The plane did end up pressurizing just fine. We did a real slow climb up to altitude and didn't go too high. I think we only went up to like 18 or something to get over the mountains. So we didn't stress it too much. But like I said, we were ready to go on oxygen if that window started failing. So then the two options were kind of, hey, do we go on oxygen and hop over the mountain? Or do we kind of peel off to the west, go more towards kind of halfway between Mozzie? There's a big valley that leads down into Bagram. So if we had to, we could hop over there and kind of work our way down at altitude. But thankfully, plane pressurized just fine, and we were able to hop over the mountain and get back as quickly as possible.
Man, that's spicy. I'm glad everything worked out. You guys made it happen. So, and obviously for that, you guys received, the whole crew received the Distinguished Flying Crosses, correct?
No, just myself. The other crew members got single action air medals for the mission.
Okay.
And then Sergeant Morin got a Purple Heart for injuries, which was, that was pretty impressive. That got handed out like 2 days later.
Wow.
So they're pretty quick on that part.
But. Random. I don't know if this is true. I saw it pop up in the meme space last week with Oppenheimer that all the Purple Hearts that are still being given out today were produced during World War II, anticipation of going to fight the Japanese, making a landing on the island there. So they produced so many Purple Hearts that they still have an inventory, which I don't know how those things are still like haven't deteriorated, but it's probably not true. I'm just spreading misinformation. Random sidebar. Here's the second sidebar. Yeah. Maestro O'Malley, I flew him in the back seat of the F-16 during the demo, and he was a champion because he wore a Jihimix. So normally I wouldn't fly with the Jihimix, the helmet-mounted queuing system that has like the big extra bubble bug eye thing on there. But it's about a pound and a half of computer that's like basically wearing a baseball hat. Well, I wouldn't do that because of the high G intensive parts of the sortie. Just more strain on your neck. But not a lot of guys at that point had just the 55P, the non-Jihimix helmet. They'd gotten rid of it. And you're just using that for NVGs as well as Jihimix. But he's back there, and I'm probably, we're running straight uphill. It's probably somewhere in the nature of 7 to 8 to 9 Gs, and his neck just snaps forward. He's got that. He was DNF for like 2 weeks, he said, afterwards. Oof. He went to the flight dock right after that, and then duties not including flying. He couldn't fly for 2 weeks. So
yeah, it's like, where's the squadron chiropractor?
Yeah, now they got him, but great leader. I hope he keeps going places in the Air Force. He's the one you want to stay around, so.
Yeah, he was because he was the wing commander, for like the listeners, when you're in charge of a wing, regulation-wise, you're allowed to fly with in any aircraft, like basically under your command. It's a bunch of restrictions and stuff, so there's nothing unsafe about it. But obviously, he was like, "Hey, I have no idea what a C-130 does, and now I'm in charge of have a whole squadron underneath me." So he wanted to go out and get some Herc experience. So my squadron commander jumped on, so because he was the certified IP at the time, because that goes along with all the restrictions on one of the missions that I was in charge of. So I'm in the jump seat watching them, and his first C-130 sortie is hopping from Bagram to Jalalabad, which is pretty impressive. That's not an easy field to go into, but he did really well. I'm like, yeah, well, this guy knows how to fly.
Yeah, I think in the probably a 4-year time span, he went from the F-35, from the F-16 to the F-35, back to the F-16 to the A-10, back to the F-16.
Yeah, he's
bouncing all over the place.
Yeah, thankfully everything's the same. Trees get bigger, trees get smaller. Yeah. So
it's nature. Well, hey, I want to jump back. What got you involved in flying in the first place? What made you want to go into the Air Force?
I was just always interested in aviation as a kid. You know, a lot of people have that, you know, air show experience type of thing. I definitely had plenty of those. My grandfather was a B-17 mechanic in World War II, and then went on to have a pretty long career in the FAA as a maintenance inspector. So he was always talking about airplanes, around airplanes. You know, we were hanging out with him this summer. He's dragging us to the airport and that kind of stuff. So definitely wanted to fly and keep that kind of in the future. And then, you know, end of high school starts rolling around and you got to kind of think like, what do I actually want to do with my life right now? So I was like, hey, let's go be a pilot. So, and let's go join the Air Force and kind of just put everything together at once. So SDSU had a flying program, so went and got my private and my instrument as part of that while I was doing ROTC, and then changed my majors to save some money once it was looking like I was going to get a pilot slot.
Let the Air Force pay for that?
Yeah, let the Air Force pay for the rest of that. And then, you know, just the standard thing after that, so IFS, pilot training, the whole nine yards.
I know you don't, you just have your path, right? But doing the MC-12 bit. So I've talked about it elsewhere on the podcast, but MC-12, that was a stopgap that the Air Force provided really for the Army, the Marines, for ground forces, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. It's about the time like drones were popping up and it became an insatiable need for more ISR overhead. Afghanistan and Iraq, Air Force, hey, here's your stopgap. Pull a King Air off the shelf. Pull a bunch of equipment off the shelf, slap it in a plane, and then they just started pulling people from different career fields. But as you mentioned, there's such a need. I mean, it was a mix from every major weapon system, from the F-22, C-17, FAPES, etc. But also, hey, you're going to graduate pilot training, you're going to do the MC-12 for 6 months, and then you're going to go to C-130, C-5, whatever it might be. Do you think that experience helped you later on down the road?
This episode is brought to you by Undeniably Dairy. Dairy farmers are more than farmers. They're climate caretakers. They see water as a precious resource. Most farmers recycle water up to 4 times, from chilling the milk to irrigating the crops. And some even use technology to turn manure into renewable energy. To learn more about what dairy farmers are doing to make their farms more sustainable, visit usdairy.com.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Some things are just better together, like party playlists and Friday nights, campfires and ghost stories, peanut butter and chocolate. And Reese's Cups are the perfect combination of creamy peanut butter and delicious milk chocolate. So, when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Buy Reese's today wherever candy is sold.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for my perspective, like, it was an awesome experience. Like, you know, your first lieutenant fresh out of pilot training is basically 6 months to the day that I graduated pilot training, almost, that I'm downrange flying combat missions, you know, contributing to the effort, where my peers in my class, you know, are maybe halfway through their FTU at that point, you know, and not anywhere towards kind of being mission qualified or anything like that. So as far as getting into the action or something like that, it was definitely a good experience. And then just the interesting part of it is because they needed so many people, like you said, they were pulling bodies from every corner of the Air Force. The squadron up at Bagram, I think, if I think back through everybody I flew with, there was probably somebody from every single airframe in that squadron. So the amount of exposure, the different people we meet, I mean, you got everybody from, like I said, brand new lieutenant out of pilot training all the way up to, you know, some crusty lieutenant colonel that wanted to get some extra flight time, you know, and left his reserve gig or whatever he was doing, you know, to go hop on an MC-12 deployment, and then everybody in between. So just the type of people that you got exposed to, and then kind of seeing all the different missions that you're supporting was definitely pretty cool.
Yeah, for me, and I've talked about it, I wanted to fly the A-10 prior to going to the MC-12 gig. I didn't have a lot of good exposure to a lot of F-16 guys going through pilot training and didn't fully understand what the F-16 did, nor the community. And fortunately for me, I was exposed to a lot of Viper guys, which made me change my dream sheet, put that number one, and I was lucky enough to get it. And then I think later on down the road too, on F-16 deployment, understanding like what those ISR platforms are capable of or what they can bring to the fight and amplify it. Because I've had guys chime in like, well, what do pilots think about drone pilots, et cetera? I was like, I was so much more lethal in F-16 when there was a drone or an unmanned aerial vehicle on station, just because they're sitting there, as you joked, you know, sitting at 0 knots on the ground. And they're sitting in a booth, right, with lots of eyeballs and high-definition cameras that can really amplify the amount of data and what your understanding of the environment is. So it's huge. That definitely played a big role for me, for sure.
Yeah, no, I grew up outside of Ellsworth, so one of the B-1 bases. So we had B-1s flying over town like my entire childhood. So that's what I thought I wanted to fly, because that was the, you know, the home state, you know, the at-home aircraft type of thing. But pilot training has a nifty way of maneuvering people into the right airframe that they're supposed to be in. So glad I ended up in the Herc.
Have you been inside awesome. A B-1?
Yep.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts, because the first time I went, I did the Dias Air Show. Buddy showed me around. This was the time when they had it's like an overwing fire, and the crew was going to eject. And the way they did it was, you know, like have the backseaters go first and then the front seaters, and there's a student backseater, and he pulled his handle and it didn't go.
Yeah.
So now what do you do? And they elected to land. Right, but I was like, man, that's a tough spot. But that was the first time I climbed up in that thing, and whoever designed that, I'm assuming it was the Soviets based on the ergonomics. I was like, there's a little tiny window down by like your knee, and knowing those guys are in the stack doing a wheel, I would be so disoriented / probably just throwing up violently in the back, just leaning, trying to like manipulate whatever you're doing back there. Then also like, oh, you got this tiny little window by your right knee or left knee. Not where I want to be in life.
Yeah, no, I mean, you definitely, that back definitely seems like quite the cave be in.
I also over-G'd the sim every single time I turned that thing. It's like,
yeah, I was only in the sim once. I'm sure I might have over-G'd it. I don't know, but I was like, this is kind of different. That tail actually diverted into Midland. So while I was a T1IP, that was one of the transition bases. We were there, you know, every other day, it seemed like. So we were doing patterns over that B-1 for 2 months. And I'm just like, yep, still there, not going anywhere.
Yeah, that would have been a little sporty. I mean, I guess good thing his seat, he was going first and didn't work. Otherwise, he's been sitting there by himself for a little bit of time.
Yeah, that would have been awkward, definitely. Yeah.
So T1IP after one round in the C-130, then now also in the schoolhouse. Can you talk to me a little bit about what your experience was like as a T1 instructor pilot? And then I know you're just starting in the Herc schoolhouse, but you've been an instructor. Like, kind of philosophy with students, what you're seeing nowadays, what your thoughts are, big picture, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, Del Rio is like a hard place to live. It's a little bit on an island, but like everybody says, when they finish that assignment, just the job was awesome. I mean, you know that from your time as a FAPE, like teaching students, seeing that light bulb come on, seeing them go from, you know, walking down the street to be able to fly an airplane is definitely rewarding, to say the least. And then it was just awesome. Awesome assignment. CT cross country was like the, you know, the reward for doing that. So you and your buddies, like in a two ship, like, hey, here's your private business jet for the weekend. Just be back on Sunday afternoon.
CT cross country. What's that? That didn't exist in my day. So always take a student. What advice would you give to students going through? Is there any tips or tricks, something that you saw that worked well or things to avoid?
I mean, just, you know, stay focused as much as you can, kind of take care of every part of your life. Like don't let something fall off. Try your best to keep all the penguins on the iceberg, that kind of thing. But really it's like, just, you know, have that commitment that this is what you want to do, and then see it through to the end, because you're definitely going to have emotions pop up in the middle of training. Like, is this for me? And it's like, no, you wanted to do this, so this is temporary. Just get to the end of it.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. Before we wrap up here, because I'm going to, again, ask you my standard question of, if you found 15 or 16-year-old walking down the street, what advice you would give him? But I'll let you think about that. I feel like I have a pretty decent idea of what's going on, at least the fighter side, based on what my buddies have told me. I'm not there anymore, right? But what is the tempo slowed down at all for, like, the C-130 world with being out of Afghanistan? Is the force able to kind of find some equilibrium when it comes to training and building experience inside the crew force? Or what's the general vibe today?
I mean, we're still pretty busy. So that tasking that was just Afghanistan has kind of moved to Kuwait to kind of be CENTCOM Airlines, more or less, since it's fairly quiet right now, but there's still, airlift's a constant need, because you constantly got people and cargo that need to get from A to B. But really, you know, the focus is on what's next. So agile combat employments, you know, the buzzword that every community's kind of coming up with. Yep, yep. Love it. So for us, that's basically, hey, how do we take a small formation, small footprint? How do we be useful to the CAF in different ways? Kind of working through those problem sets. Obviously, you got threats in Eastern Europe, threats in the Pacific. So working through, like, what those problem sets look like, how we're going to contribute. You got new systems coming online, like Rapid Dragon, that just made its, like, public debut, basically. So all these new things coming, it's keeping the community pretty busy.
Yeah, interesting. All right, pivoting to 15, 16-year-old you, and I think you're going to hang around for a There I Was story when that's all said and done. But is there any advice you would give him? Change anything?
I wouldn't change anything. It's been a heck of a ride so far, so we'll keep going. But advice I'd give 15, 16-year-old would be, stay busy. Always be learning something new. Because I'm not that old, but as you get older, like, time just keeps moving faster and faster. So don't wait for tomorrow to do something that you want to get after. Like, get after it now, because it's only going to keep moving faster.
Dude, it's cliche, I would say, but that is so true. I mean, I say that all the time now, and you really feel it as you get older. It's just, you're not guaranteed tomorrow. So, Chris, thanks for joining me on the podcast, man. It was very interesting to hear about the 19th of September. And, again, when this releases, it's probably going to be on the 3-ish year anniversary, plus or minus a couple days. But that's definitely quite a sporty environment. And so just to hear and where you were in that time and what went down was very interesting. So thanks for sharing that with me, and thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was awesome.
Cheers, brother.
See ya.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgearin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately, well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold in the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the Hurt Locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yeah, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.